It was two things. It was the ever-deepening depression. Everybody made speeches about the ever-deepening depression. And the anti-war movement, which was based on this Oxford Pledge, which started at Oxford in England. The students at Oxford University, you pledged that you would never participate in any war.
Reading and writing on the road to power. Socialist women on campus in the 1930s. Part 5 in a series of programs exploring the activities and achievements of militant women in the decade of the Great Depression.
My family were Democrats. I didn't become involved or interested, except in school. I was, you know, a smarty pants kid in Wadley High School. And I remember becoming very involved with the Irish Rebellion in 1916. It wasn't until the 1928 election when LaGuardia and Walker were running for mayor, and neither of them appealed to me. I felt that Mayor Walker was a crook and LaGuardia was a bombastic little Italian that I just couldn't buy. But I happened to hear Norman Thomas. We had a radio set at home because I didn't go to a meeting. I must have heard him on the radio. And he appealed to me. I felt that this was a man that I could vote for. I liked what he said, and I felt that I could vote for him. So I was very happy to have someone to vote for in 1928. I knew nothing about socialism per se.
The bakers will bake, ho ho! When the brewers brew and folks, we'll all get a break. Yes, sir.
Among the major groups active on the left in the 1930s, the Socialist Party was perhaps the oldest and the most experienced.
No more bombing, no sir, we'll all go to work. There's a new day coming.
Organized through a succession of mergers at the turn of the century, the Socialist Party worked for labor reform and distinguished itself in the fight to keep America out of World War I.
Fellow workers and comrades, the socialist movement is as wide as the world, and its mission is to win the world, the whole world, from animalism and consequence.
In 1920, its candidate for president, Eugene Debs, polled nearly a million votes while jailed for his anti-war activities.
To win a world is worthy of a race of gods. And in the winning...
But division within weakened the socialist position, with one split leading to the formation of the Communist Party in 1919. It was not until 1928 that the Socialist Party again ran its own candidate for president. Norman Thomas was to lead the socialists through the Depression years and five presidential elections.
We intend to wage war against poverty with more vigor than men waged war against foreign foes. We intend to put
Alice Dodge
to
Wolfson.
Well, when I went to Vassar, I said I was
housing,
a socialist, but I really didn't know a thing about it. I just felt that was my subconscious, unconscious inclination. Then along came the Depression, and everybody began talking about world conditions and the unemployment and the situation in the country. And Norman Thomas came to speak at college. And he got up there with his imposing presence on the platform and his wonderful voice and his lucid prose, and he said exactly the things that I felt.
Were I to tell you that we had a perfect plan, or supermen, and offer such perfection as your way of salvation, only the workers themselves, with hand and brain, can save themselves.
Thomas's ministerial charisma was of enormous importance to the growth of the Socialist Party in the 30s. His appeal was widely felt among young idealists on campus and in the academic milieu. Alice Marsh had already entered the teaching profession.
In 1931, my husband happened to make friends with someone where he worked, and we visited his house in Sunnyside. He was a socialist, and he started to tell us about the branch and all. And of course, I, very smarty pants, I said, "Oh, I'm a socialist. I voted for Norman Thomas." Well, at that point, he let me know how little I knew about socialism. And both my husband and I then went to the Rand School, and we took some courses down there and found out that there was much more to being a socialist than voting for Norman Thomas. The economics of the country were very bad, and I felt that socialists had an answer. They made good sense to me. So I joined the Socialist Party, and at the same time that I joined the Socialist Party, I also joined the Teachers Union. Now, I'd been teaching since 1924 and never heard of the Teachers Union until I joined the Socialist Party. But when I joined the party, the first thing that they said, you ought to join the Teachers Union too. So I did both. I joined the party and the union and became very active in both.
Alice Wolfson.
I also went to Europe the summer of 31, and I was impressed with how the students in Europe were all very much involved in national and international affairs. They were very active politically, while American students so far seem to have been taking no interest in public affairs. And I decided that I'd like to do something about that, so I came back to college and I joined the LID, the League for Industrial Democracy, which had a very active chapter at Vassar.
The Socialist Party helped young women from many backgrounds to understand the economic crisis and to enter struggles far from their schools. As the 1932 elections drew near, campus socialists put their efforts to winning the presidential straw polls.
So in the fall, I put on a marvelous campaign. It was one of the best jobs I ever did in my life because I was full of enthusiasm. We were going to have a straw vote on the campus, and I was sure that each additional vote for Norman Thomas would influence the entire national election because the eyes of the country were on the straw votes in the colleges. And as the colleges voted, so would vote the country, so I felt. And actually, in our straw vote, we had a majority for Thomas on the faculty. And the student body, Thomas got about twice as many votes as Roosevelt did. However, the bulk of the students voted for Hoover because that was the way their parents voted.
Florence Rossi.
32 was a very big year. That was the year that Thomas ran and got a tremendous number of votes for the Socialist Party. I remember the first time I heard him, there was a meeting at Town Hall, and I was turned to a pulp. And then came this big meeting in Madison Square Garden. By then I had joined, and our headquarters were 167th Street and Jerome Avenue. And we had a lot of students there, City College, you know. And I remember we made this big banner. This was for the Columbia group. It said, Columbia professors may work with Roosevelt, but Columbia students vote for Thomas. Columbia students had voted for Thomas in a straw ballot at Columbia.
The party's traditional strong opposition to war also attracted young progressive women who were active outside of socialist circles. Faye Bennett.
I got no radical ideas at home, and it wasn't until I went to college that I had my mind opened up, as it were. And I went to Simmons in Boston. It was in the height of the Depression. Greater Boston has a lot of colleges, as you know, Boston, MIT, women's colleges, Wheaton, Wellesley.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of student activities, and peace people came, and I heard the leaders of the time, with John Haynes Holmes and Norman Thomas. And it was through the Y that I got interested in peace.
In 1933, Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany.
Then, sometime about 1934, the student strike against war developed in New York with the Student League for Industrial Democracy, which I didn't know anything about, but it got attention. And in Boston, we had student strikes against war, and we had one on the Simmons campus. We formed a peace committee, which I was chairman of. I was became very active. I became president of the YWCA on campus, the peace committee, the student activities committee, Greater Boston activities. And we went to the college president. By that time, we had a pretty good guy, and he agreed. And the physics department cooperated and hooked up the loudspeakers. Really? And we got a retired general or admiral to come and talk on campus. And instead of having to strike against the administration, they cooperated. And students were encouraged to come, and that was the beginning. And we had something on Boston Common. Mm-hmm. I remember a greater Boston student thing, and I was one of the speakers, and I remember a Boston newspaper saying an earnest blonde from Simmons spoke. That was me.
The communists were openly opposed to socialists up until 1935 and accused them of being social fascists. This conflict was borne out in radical circles on campus. The focus of the student peace movement was the Oxford Pledge. Florence Rossi.
The communist, there was a different, the socialist had one form of the pledge and the communist had another form. The communist only swore that they would not participate in any imperialist war. The socialist said they would not participate in any war. But it was a very big thing in the student movement, you see, for people to, you know, sign up for the Oxford Pledge and so on.
Conflict between the socialists and the communists had been intense, and violence was not unknown. One confrontation in the spring of 1934 had left particularly deep scars. Alice Marsh.
We were supposed to have a great big meeting at Madison Square Garden when the socialists in Austria, in Vienna, were fired upon by the Dollfuss group. This was before Hitler came into Austria, and everyone was very upset by this, the socialists, the communists, the ILG, and they planned a great big meeting at Madison Square Garden. And I was teaching, of course, so I didn't get into the city until after 3 o'clock. I got there probably about 4 o'clock, and as I walked from the station toward the garden, there was such a mob of people, so many of them, and I became frightened. I just being in such a big mob upset me. So when I got up close to the garden and I saw the crowds, terrible crowds there, I don't know what it was in myself, but I didn't go in. I turned around and I left. And of course that was the meeting where the communists broke up the meeting by, I found out later, I wasn't there, throwing the chairs and creating a real brouhaha. And because of that, we at that point realized that we could not work with the communists, that they would destroy anything that we were trying to do, that we were their greatest enemy, and that it was futile to try to combine with them.
The communists were very very important part of our lives at that time because they destroyed everything they possibly could. So part of our battle was constantly fighting the communists because they really were an element of unalleviated destruction. So we had our problem with them. In school, we had our problem with them, too. It's an insidious thing. Whatever it is you're trying to do that's constructive, they try to destroy it. That's all. It's hard to... Mm-hmm. I mean, you can take a dramatic example like that famous meeting in Madison Square Garden in favor of the Austrian socialists. Yeah. I was there, and where they came with the furriers, with knives, and where they physically destroyed everything.
Despite the opposing viewpoints among campus activists, the Oxford Pledge movement grew during these years. The best way to end a war is not to let it start. In 1934, as part of the first in a number of student anti-war strikes in the decade, 25,000 American youths took the pledge. Within 2 years, that number grew to over 500,000.
Uncle Sam sits this one out.
It
was kind of a pacifist thing. I don't think we used that word pacifist, but we didn't think wars were accomplishing anything. They were just killing people and not providing political solutions. So it was sort of educational. I don't think we thought through the whole thing or the economic links, but we were learning fast.
While statistics reflect the considerable effort and the success of radical activists on campus, many students who took the Oxford Pledge did not belong to either the Socialist or the Communist Party. In 1935, the Communists adopted a new tactic, agreeing to work with other leftists in a single so-called popular front. The American Student Union was formed late in the year by a merger of socialist and communist student groups, along with some church and liberal organizations. Faye Bennett was a field worker and secretary to the director of the ASU.
By that time, I was sort of becoming to be a socialist. And even though I was being wooed by communists and socialists and so on, and there was not much difference between them, it seemed like. You know, they were sort of, I don't know how you, politically, they were all sort of hewing the same line, it seemed like. But I veered toward the socialists because I liked the people better. They were just more my kind of people. I sort of had more faith in them. And the communists, I didn't know very well, and I guess, I don't know whether it was prejudice. I don't think it was prejudice. I just think I had the feeling, it was just an intuition that I somehow didn't trust them as much.
Florence Rossi.
Listen, I want you to know, when I first came around to the so-called movement and the communists, who spent a lot of time trying to win me over after they saw that I was such a bleeding heart, and when they didn't succeed, they said I was a betrayer of the working classes, and I cried bitterly. I really did, because I really wasn't a betrayer of the working classes, and they called me a betrayer of the working classes, and I really thought that, you know, they really meant I was a betrayer of the working class. That's how seriously we took those things.
It does not seem surprising that when the communists did try to form a united front on the left, many socialists were skeptical. Was it from unwillingness to forgive and forget? More likely, it was the socialist perception of fundamental differences in principle.
We're individualists. We get together, we try to formulate a policy, but even a policy that is formulated by the whole, the majority, if there's someone in the group that still doesn't agree with it, if he feels strongly enough about it, he leaves the party. He doesn't have to stay. You know, there's no strings attached. And if he doesn't feel that strongly about it, he says, yeah, I don't agree with that, but there are so many other things, so you stay. And that's the way Socialist Party runs. It's not a... It's a democratic organization, but it is not a totalitarian one. It's not a dictatorship. No one can tell you what to think or what to believe. And, of course, in some ways, that's one of our bad faults, because we can't force anyone to do what the majority thinks they should do.
This tolerance of criticism may have actually encouraged the growth of factions within the Socialist Party.
There was the right wing, and we were the left wing. The right wing was just very old people. They would say, we've been in the party for 25 years, and we looked at them 25 years. Why should be in your grave? You know? They were probably 40 years old or something. Who on you for 25 years, you know? So they were, we believed in, I forget now, we're going to take over the barricade or something, and reform was terrible and only revolution was good and so on. The split with the old guard, we were still full of, fire and Sturm und Drang. We were still having hot discussions on the road to power, so.
This new generation of socialists was itself far from homogeneous. The urgency of the struggle rendered some of the distinctions irrelevant.
Girls were never elected to the executive committee or of anything. We were the secretary. Okay. We didn't sit in the class struggle. I mean, just because you were a woman, you were either on, you were a worker or a capitalist. What difference does it make whether you were a woman or not? There was no... You never thought in those terms. You were on your side of the class struggle. You could be any gender at all. It didn't make any difference. Because, see, we used to have a lot of these very erudite discussions about the road to power, and everybody read all these pamphlets, you know. You know, there were all these great discussions. And all the boys could quote. They used to quote by the hour, you know. I remember once a group of us females got together and we said, we're just as smart as they are. We just can't quote, that's all. We just don't read all those pamphlets, and we certainly don't memorize them. We're gonna get together every week and we're gonna memorize. I think we got together twice and we degenerated. We were gonna show those boys that we were just as smart as they were. But we couldn't quote Marx and Engels. We had a lot of social things going at the same time, you know. We were constantly going to hikes and parties and dances and, you know, we were together like on a 24-hour basis. So that, you know, it was a very close relationship we developed over the years. And on the one hand, we were very hot about socialism, you know, that was no phony. I mean, we took courses at the Rand School and so on, you know. So it was a very full life, and we picketed. That was part of our day. It was as much part of our day as taking a course at the Rand School or having a fundraising party someplace. It was all part of the same pie.
How did Florence's parents feel about her involvement in the movement?
Well, I tell you, they didn't really object to the politics of it, but they just objected to the hours. And the, you know, I mean, sex was not just invented, you know, and we used to come home at 4 or 5 in the morning and constantly. My mother was also disturbed because we wasted so much literature with all these literature piled up high that we never got to finish distributing or something. But my family was sympathetic to, you know, they were Forbes readers and they were always sympathetic to the socialist point of view. That didn't mean they were sympathetic to the way of life that I adopted, you know.
The intimacy of the socialist milieu and education provided by such institutions as the Rand School in New York helped the party to unite on policy and on specific issues. Alice Marsh recalls the struggle in the teachers' union at the time.
Within the union, in the early days, there was a group that was the original founders of the union. They were called the administration. They had won the loyalty of most of the members that they had. And the newer people coming in wanted the union to be more militant, have more mass meetings and things like that. One of the groups within the opposition to the administration was the rank and file. Now, the rank and file was led by people in the Communist Party. Not all rank and filers were communists, but the leadership of that group certainly was. They were definitely communists. Then there was the people who had once been in the Communist Party, and the J. Lovestone group that had been thrown out of the Communist Party by Russia. The Lovestonites had been the majority of the American communists, but Russia decided that Foster should be the Communist Party, so they were thrown out of the regular Communist Party. So they called themselves the Communist Party Opposition. And then there was another group of Trotskyites, those that were followers of Leon Trotsky, who was also persona non grata with the rank and file and also with the communist opposition. And then there were the socialists. There was no question that the ideology of all these different groups on the union, for the sake of the teachers, was good. We did help to make life easier for the teachers, and we did do a lot of good things. But within the union, the conflicts and the pulling and striving created other problems. But that came a little bit later when I came back after having my maternity leave. That wasn't in those very early days. Came 1935, and the administration, of course, was becoming very unhappy with the situation in the union, and they tried to have the communists and probably some of the rest of us thrown out on the grounds that we were disrupting the meetings. And it is true, meetings occasionally, frequently, were disrupted. When someone in the administration was talking, there'd be loud shouts from the meeting, challenging what they were saying, or there would be groups of people would gather around one person in the who was in the administration and would belittle whoever was talking if they were from the other side. It was a character assassination, and it was done very deliberately.
The National Labor Relations Act of 1935 and other New Deal legislation actually met many of the socialist demands in the labor struggle. Events in Europe made their other demands more pressing. In 1936, armed conflict broke out in Spain. In March of 38, Germany annexed Austria. Anti-war activists moved off of the campus and into the cities of the nation. Alice Wolfson.
Anti-war forces were coming together, and this was the spring of 38. The socialists and three or four or five of the old line peace organizations got together. The Fellowship of Reconciliation, the War Resisters League, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and a few trade unionists and the Socialist Party all got together and formed something called the Keep America Out of War Committee. And they held a conference in Washington in late May 1938.
Faye Bennett.
That was 1938. The Keep America Out of War Congress was set up, and a youth committee against war, and I came east for the big Keep America Out of War Congress rally in Washington. And I was anti-war, and I guess they were for collective security, you see, and our wing was not. We thought that was just a ruse to get us into the war. We were sort of lined up with the isolationists, even though we weren't isolationists. We were true internationalists who did not believe in war. Mm-hmm. Collective security with all the big capitalist countries that were preparing for war looked like just a way of developing one side for a war against Germany and its allies. And we weren't pro-Nazi by any means, but we didn't think war was the way to solve problems.
For a generation of young Americans who believed in peace, the Socialist Party had been a source of strength, a model of unswerving conviction.
But then the interest began to fade somehow. I mean, there'd been a lot of excitement at the time of that Congress in the spring, and it gradually faded. There wasn't so much financial support anyway. We did have another big demonstration in Washington the spring of 41. There was plenty to do. I edited a newsletter. I had extensive correspondence. I tried to raise money. And there were lots of people who were very active, and lots of students used to come into the office. Faye Bennett was there running the youth section called the Youth Committee Against War, and there were lots of students and young people around. It was a very busy place, actually. There just wasn't much money. I was there from the beginning of 39 until December 7th, 1941, and was working very hard and having fun, really.
America entered the war on December 8th. It was the end of an era. For the activist women who had come of age in the anti-war movement, the defeat came as something of an anticlimax. While issues die, ideals do not. Nor do fears born of long experience. Socialists, above all, were not likely to forget the imprisonment of war resistors in 1917. Their work was not quite done. Faye Bennett.
We were fully convinced that if we went to war, we'd become a dictatorship at home. And we said that, and we thought that you had to have that, that all opposition would be silenced, that there wouldn't be any more free speech, that anti-war people would be thrown in jail as they were in World War I. And we thought that would be happening, and we were fighting against that. Well, it didn't happen. I mean, there wasn't that. We weren't silenced.
Remember my forgotten man. You put a rifle in his hand.
You have been listening to Readin' and Writin' on the Road to Power, part 5 of Grandma Was an Activist, a radio series on radical women in the 1930s, produced for WBAI-FM and the Oral History of the American Left at New York University's Tamiment Institute Library. Oral historians for the series, John Bloom, B. Lemish, and Ruth Prager. Project directors, Paul and Mary Jo Buell. Mix by Stephen Erickson. Our special thanks to the many interviewees and contributors who made this series possible.
Won't you bring him back again? 'Cause ever since the world began, a woman's got to have a man. Forgetting him, you see, means you're forgetting me, like my forgotten man.
Grandma Was an Activist was produced by Beth Friend and Charles Potter, Radio Arts Incorporated. Your narrator is Jill Eikenberry. Grandma Was an Activist was made possible by a grant from the New York Council for the Humanities. Be sure to listen to the sixth and final part in this series, The Militant Muse, Activist Women in the Arts in the Great Depression, over this same station.